I thought I would just touch on a sort of three points where I think immunology may have an impact on the sort of physiology. And so I'm going to touch briefly on the role of the endometrial glands and their secretion during the first trimester of human pregnancy, the importance of remodeling the spiral arteries in terms of the blood flow pattern into the placenta, and then touch on something that, about sort of deportation of trophoblast material during pregnancy, ties in a little bit with what Chris says, but it expands his work because he was very modest, I think, on that. Anthony mentioned yesterday that there are two ways of providing nutrients to the mammalian embryo. There is the histiotrophic form of nutrition, which is where the trophoblast absorbs secretions from the oviduct or the uterine glands. And of course, that is the first form of nutrition that every blastocyst encounters as it moves along the oviduct and then resides in the uterine lumen. And then later, there is hemotrophic nutrition, which is an interchange between maternal and fetal circulations. And for that, you need the placenta. And of course, in placental mammals, that has become the predominant means of transport, although, as Anthony pointed out yesterday, you can, in certain animals, have the two mechanisms operating side by side. What you would read in the human embryology textbooks still today is that we have the blastocyst implanting into the uterine wall. It is complete by about day 11 post-fertilization. There it is there. You can see it even at 9 days after fertilization. The uterine epithelium has almost completely reformed over the surface of the conceptus. There is the embryo. This is the differentiating placenta here. And this is a form of implantation only really seen in the great apes and the human, and relates to what Peter's just been describing, really. And from that point of view, people have perhaps, because of this desire to see an evolutionary advantage in the larger brain, said that the histiotrophic form of nutrition is very short in the human, because the blastocyst is removed from the uterine lumen, which is where the secretions are supposed to be. And instead, they depict this early onset of blood flow through the developing placenta, even showing a sort of oxygenation, deoxygenation of the blood as it goes through at day 11. And this, as I say, is an account that anybody looking at a sort of standard embryological text, especially if it was published before the last few years, you'll find. And this was all challenged, really, by Houston and Scapps in a seminal paper in 1987, a Belgian pathologist and an obstetrician. And they presented data from three different sources indicating that there was little, if any, maternal blood flow to the human placenta before about 10 weeks of pregnancy, the end of the first trimester. So this is much, much later than 10 days. So here we are with at 8 to 9 weeks of pregnancy. If you do Doppler ultrasound, you pick up signals indicative of maternal blood flow in the endometrium. You don't actually see them in the body of the placenta. They had some hysterectomy specimens at 8 to 9 weeks. They perfused the uterine arteries with radioopaque dye. It filled the uterus very nicely. It didn't fill the placenta at all. And they actually inserted a hysteroscope into the intervillous space of the placenta, and they saw it was filled with a clear fluid. And then they repeated these at 12 to 13 weeks, then the placenta immediately filled with the radioopaque dye, and they saw a pink blush of maternal blood in the intervillous space. And this was very heretical at the time, and it met with an awful lot of opposition, because people said, how on earth can the embryo survive for 10 weeks of pregnancy without having maternal blood flow? And our sort of contribution really was to go back to an archival collection of placentas in situ that we have here in Cambridge, collected by Dixon Boyd when he was the professor of anatomy. And this was this is the earliest specimen we have, which is 4 weeks post-conception, 6 weeks of pregnancy. What you see is the conceptors here. This is the developing placenta. The embryo would have been in the space here. And you can see that it is sitting on top of some very active endometrial glands. And if you go to the serial sections and follow these through, you can see that these endometrial glands are discharging their secretions into the cavity of the placenta. So instead of maternal blood being in the intervillous space, these are uterine secretions, which are very familiar to people like Doug, who see it in the horse. It's been known for many years, but it was discounted in the human because of this assumption that they didn't have access to the placenta. They do have access to the placenta, and they're filling the intervillous space with that clear fluid. So I think the glands are very important. We were able to stain some of these sections. Boyd, when he prepared them, he left some uncover slipped. So we were able to take one of these slides, which was prepared in the 1960s, and do some immunohistochemistry for a protein produced uniquely in the uterine glands. You can see it fluorescing very strongly in the glands, and then filling the intervillous space between the villi, which appear as the sort of black shapes here. And you can then actually see that it is taken up in the trophoblast covering the villi. So they are phagocytosing these endometrial secretions, and we believe they're being broken down and used as a source of nutrients, just like in the yolk sac of the rodent at this stage of pregnancy. So this is a very different way of providing nutrients to the embryo instead of maternal blood. And the exciting thing is that in domestic species, it is now well known that the conceptor signals to the glands to increase the supply of these uterine milk proteins in early pregnancy. So this is work of Tom Spencer in the sheep, and it signals via interferon tau, which is the molecule of recognition of pregnancy in the sheep, as well as placental lactogens through the prolactin receptor and the growth hormone receptor. The combination of the two acts as a servo mechanism, which increases the secretions. So that's a really neat system whereby the conceptus comes into the uterus, says, I'm here, I need some nourishment, please upregulate. And so we speculated many years ago that the same sort of mechanism may operate in the human. Instead of interferon tau, we have HCG. The receptor for HCG is on the glandular epithelium, as is prolactin receptor, as is growth hormone receptor. So the right receptors are in the right place. We, of course, yet don't know whether they are stimulating the upregulation of secretions. But it's an attractive proposition. And we've got sort of three pieces of circumstantial evidence that this is the case. Firstly, the glands adopt a very different morphology in early pregnancy. The pathologists will recognize the ariastella transformation, which is a sort of, it adopts a hypersecretory form. Second, we can take an immortalized gland cell line and place prolactin or progesterone on it, and we get increased secretions. And thirdly, I'll show you in a minute that the nature of the secretions actually changes. So this is what we think is the possible signaling pathways. We have HCG, placental lactogen, coming from the trophoblast. That may stimulate the glandular epithelium directly. Or, alternatively, the HCG maintains the corpus luteum. The corpus luteum produces progesterone, produces decidualization. And one of the things decidual cells produce in enormous quantities in the human is prolactin. And that, of course, could provide stimulation directly to those glandular epithelial cells. And it's very interesting that the prolactin from the decidua is driven by a different promoter than in the pituitary. It is a transposable element that was inserted into the mammalian radiation around 20, 30 million years ago, around the time of divergence of the old world monkeys. So it has been suggested that the insertion of this transposon enabled deep placentation to evolve. So the other thing, I mean, we shouldn't think of these glands just as a supply of nutrients, because they also secrete large quantities of growth factors, cytokines, and they have transport proteins on their surface. So we've done immunohistochemistry. We know that they are immunopositive for LIF, VEGF, EGF, all of which are potent mitogens. And if you place EGF onto early trophoblast, you will stimulate proliferation. So it's not just nutrients. There is the possibility that these glands are really stimulating proliferation of the trophoblast. And then we found a very interesting finding. And I think this is the third piece of evidence that there may be a signaling from the conceptus to the glands, but something is changing, and that is the pattern of sialation of these secretions. So that if we go to the late secretory phase of the non-pregnant cycle, and we use this lectin here, which detects galactose side chains, you don't get any staining. If you then remove the sialic acid end cap with neuraminidase, you do get some nice staining. Do the same in early pregnancy, and you see staining immediately of these glandular secretions. So what is the significance of that? Well, the significance, I believe, is that that enables you to create a unique microenvironment within the placenta, because when those secretions without the sialic acid end cap get into the maternal circulation, they will be cleared immediately in one pass by her liver using the asialoglycoprotein receptors. So here you have a beautiful system, in fact, that the conceptus can signal to the glands can secrete high concentrations of very pro-mitotic growth factors, and yet when they get into the maternal circulation, as they will, she immediately clears them from her liver. And so you can stimulate placental development without putting the rest of the mother at risk of tumorigenesis in this way. And it's the only way in which you can do that, because you cannot put the concentration of VEGF or EGF up in her circulation without the risk of tumorigenesis. And so I think this is a really neat biological system. You probably don't need to do the same in an epithelio-choral situation because it's within the uterine lumen. But if you are in a hemochorial situation, you run that risk. And I think this is an example, again, of how evolution has perhaps adapted to these different situations. So that's one factor of the glands, is this stimulation of proliferation. The other consequence of histiotrophic nutrition, and another piece of the evidence we provided that really sort of meant that the concept was actually accepted, was that colleague Eric Jonnieu measured the oxygen concentration within the placenta at prior to terminations of pregnancy, which were performed at different gestational ages. So this is not a longitudinal study. Each of these data points is an individual. But you can see that the oxygen concentration is around 20 millimeters of mercury prior to about 10 weeks of pregnancy. And then by about 12 weeks of pregnancy, it has gone up almost threefold to around 60 millimeters. And that coincides with this change in the observations made by Houston and Scaps many years ago of the going from a clear fluid to maternal blood. At the time, we thought this was an advantage really to the fetus because it reduces the production of free radicals and perhaps avoids teratogenesis. But more and more, when you look in the stem cell literature, you now see that stem cells in many niches are in a relatively low oxygen environment of around 2 to 5% sort of oxygen. And what we're measuring in that first trimester placenta is around 2.5% oxygen. So what you're creating is in fact a highly stimulatory microenvironment within the placenta with these secretions, but also keeping the oxygen concentration low, which probably maintains stem cell niches and allows that very rapid proliferation of the trophoblast. So why is that important? Well, this is our early specimen again. Here at the placental villi, this is the decidua, that's the uterine gland. And at the boundary around the whole of the developing placenta, there is a band of cytotrophoblast cells that form a shell, the cytotrophoblastic shell. And this is normally nicely well developed, and trophoblast cells from the shell plug those maternal arteries and prevent the inflow of maternal blood into the placenta. And what we know from cases of miscarriage is that that shell is either very poorly formed or incomplete in those cases. And so what you might imagine is that plugging of the maternal arteries is not as extensive as it should be. So in those cases, what you see clinically is early onset of blood flow into the placenta. So there's our normal Doppler ultrasound, no flow actually within the placental tissues, that's within the umbilical cord. This is what you would see in a case of miscarriage. You can detect evidence of blood flow within the body of the placenta at prior to 10 weeks of pregnancy. And any obstetrician seeing that will know that that pregnancy will miscarry spontaneously if you don't do anything within the next 2 weeks. And what we showed was that the tissues undergo extensive oxidative stress. So I think, for me, the most important thing in the first trimester, and Chris emphasized how important the first trimester is to setting up the whole of pregnancy, is this rapid proliferation of the trophoblast, the formation of the shell, the plugging of these arteries, and for that, I think the activity of the glands is critically important. And my sort of question really is, although we think of prolactin as being the stimulus, perhaps for gland activity, is it possible that interactions between the EVT and the NK cells are not only remodeling the arteries, as we know they do from Anne and Jens's work, but are they also signaling to the glands and increasing glandular activity? And so I think we should think about that, because it would explain Ashley's sort of miscarriage data, which you can't really explain from lack of remodeling of the arteries directly. So just to briefly comment on why we should remodel spiral arteries. Why is it important? How could that relate to birth weight? So what we know, Ashley has shown a nice diagram. This is some reconstructions that were done by Harris and Ramsey, again in the older literature in 66. They had pregnancy hysterectomy specimens. They had serial sections. They drew on acetate sheets from the serial sections, and then an artist did this 3D reconstruction. This was the days before computers. And we actually have the acetate sheets in the CTR that they did these reconstructions from. This is at term, and you can see the spiral artery coming up through the myometrium, entering the endometrium, and then discharging into the intervillous space. And usefully, in the caption of that illustration, he said that the maximum diameter of that mouth of the artery is 2.5 or 2.4 millimeters diameter. So if we take 2.4 millimeters here and sort of work back, we get a diameter as the spiral artery enters the endometrium of about 0.5 of a millimeter. So what we're seeing is a dilation from 0.5 up to 2.5. What is the consequence of that for blood flow? In every paper you read about preeclampsia or IUGR, you will read that reduction or deficient conversion of the spiral artery leads to hypoxia. How can that possibly be the case when, in fact, this part of the artery is going to be the rate-limiting step of the artery, and that is never invaded by trophoblast? Yes, it undergoes remodeling under the effect of hormones, but it is not a trophoblast-dependent process. So we did some mathematical modeling, or I didn't do the mathematical modeling, but a fluid dynamicist did, because he used this formula. And I couldn't do that, but there are a number of basic assumptions in here that you have to make as to how much the artery dilates, what the pressure drop is, etc., etc. Anyway, there are assumptions. This is not going to be definitive, but the interesting thing that comes out of this is the effect on the velocity of the blood as it enters the intervillous space. So the thing, the solid line here is velocity. And you have to make an assumption about the viscosity of the blood. So we took the maximum and minimum range that is within the literature. And this is a logarithmic scale. So if this artery has not dilated, and it has a diameter of 0.5 of a millimeter, or radius of 0.25, the velocity of the blood flow is in the region of 2 to 4 meters per second. It is flowing very rapidly. If you dilate that artery to 2.5 millimeters at the mouth, you reduce the velocity by an order of magnitude. It now enters the villous space at around 10 to 20 centimeters per second. And so this is a very much more gradual entry of the blood into the intervillar space, and I think it's almost been sort of confirmed by measurements that Sally Collins has made in Oxford, where she has actually measured the velocity at the mouths of spiral arteries. I think she gets something in the region of 20 to 30 centimeters a second. So although we've made all sorts of assumptions in here, in vivo measurements are sort of bearing this out. Why is that important? Well, if you have rapid blood flow into the placenta, you cause the sort of damage that Chris showed this morning. People have tried that in vitro. You're power washing the placenta. You're knocking off all sorts of bits of trophoblast, which are then being circulated into the mother. It doesn't really have very much of an effect actually on the volume of the flow of blood, because, as I say, this area here is going to be rate limiting. So yes, it reduces the resistance to flow, and the volume does go up theoretically by about 30%, but the major impact is on the velocity. We heard this morning, you know, can you show this in vitro? Well, here's a couple of videos I thought you might like to see at this stage of the afternoon. But this is a normal pregnancy. These are given to me by John Kingdom. And this is a case of severe IUGR associated with deficient conversion of the spiral arteries. So what John is going to do in this is going to move focus up and down through the placenta, and what you'll see on the normal is that there will be some spaces appearing in the placenta, but they are nice and uniformly black in the same way that the ventricles of the brain are uniformly black, because if it's black, it means there's very little blood flow. So if we look at the normal, he will, as I say, move up and down through the placenta, and some spaces will appear, but they are sort of black. I'll just do that again. They're just nice and uniformly black. Note that the placenta is also the sort of shape that you would see when it is delivered. This one, on the other hand, is a totally different shaped placenta. You can see it even now. It is a much more globular placenta. And when John moves up and down through the placenta, you'll see these big spaces. And what you'll see is a shimmering grayness, which indicates fast flow of blood through this placenta. Oops. So you can see here, that is there is a shimmering in that space there, indicating very rapid blood flow. So here we think that this unconverted artery is delivering blood at a very fast rate, which is creating these massive channels through the placenta. And that, of course, is giving rise to the stress and damage to the placenta, and of course that is going to lead consequently to poor placental function and IUGR. And it would be very interesting, I mean, Anne and Jens have the opportunity to actually look at the mouse placental arteries, get true measurements from those, and do some mathematical modeling and see whether that matches up with velocities that you can measure. So that force of blood going into the placenta is going to cause mechanical damage. Now, Chris mentioned this morning three frontiers. I think there are more frontiers than that, and Chris and Ian, and it's a shame Ian can't be here today, have really emphasized the importance of deportation of bits of the placenta to the mother. So we know from this work of Schmorlin in 1893, that bits of the placenta fall off during pregnancy, and they are caught in the capillaries of the lungs. So this is actually trophoblast within the pulmonary capillaries, because this is the first vascular bed that these bits of trophoblast come up through the inferior vena cava, right atrium, right ventricle, pulmonary arteries into the lungs, where they seem to cause no reaction at all. But people have sort of begun to take a little more attention to these. I mean, presumably they're MHC negative, so they're not going to cause an immunological reaction. But they're now known to be both translationally, transcriptionally and translationally active. So these bits of the placenta, which were thought to just be inert, if you transfect them with GFP, you see the expression of the GFP, and if you transfect them with a vector encoding the soluble receptor for VEGF, again, the ones which are transfected actually secrete soluble FLT into the supernatant, so they are translating the protein and they are secreting the protein. So there's another barrier, at least, in the maternal peripheral circulation, and Chris's work with Ian has shown that the placenta is shedding all sorts of bits of debris, some which are relatively healthy, some which are more necrotic, right down to the exosome level, and we know that there are microRNAs on those exosomes, and so you have the possibility that the placenta is signaling to the mother in a much more extensive way than just in the placental bed or the amniochoria, but throughout her whole circulation. And what that means in terms of tolerance or what it means in terms of preeclampsia, I think we're only just beginning to scratch the surface. So these are the sort of questions, just as a sort of more as a physiologist, I would sort of pose. So certainly glandular activity is key, I think, in the first trimester for normal pregnancy, for prevention of miscarriage. Question there is, does the maternofetal immune dialogue influence gland activity? We know that spiral arterial remodeling is key and involves the NK cells. My take on it is that it has a greater impact on velocity of maternal blood flow rather than the volume. We know that a failure of the remodeling leads to physical damage of the villus tree and creating damage, as Chris said, that may expose fetal antigens. And then I think this is a whole new and very exciting area, the deportation of the trophoblast exosomal signaling really opens up unforeseen opportunities for this materno-fetal immune dialogue. So those are just some thoughts, really, that I know we all, you've been focusing on the placental bed in this meeting and other areas, but I think that there are other sites where this immune interactions can operate, and physiologically, how do they translate into effects on birth weight? Well, it could be through effects on the uterine glands, and equally, it can be through effects on blood flow. So those are a few thoughts that were just sort of put together fairly randomly.